I sold out those books, and then I had a second printing. And I've been writing about the crash of 2008 for several years. I wrote an article on the theory of the business cycle, combining the Austrian school theory that has to do with money and credit and interest rates and capital goods with the Georges theory having to do with land and land speculation. I found each of those to be incomplete, but when you put them together, they're highly complementary, and you get a very powerful explanation that fits the economic history. So I published that in 1997 in the American Journal of Economics and Sociology. There, so I presented the theory of the business cycle, and I went through the history of the real estate cycle in the United States, and with a chart that you see over here. This 18 should be over here, but you can see that there's been a real estate cycle going back to the early 1800s in the United States with an average duration of 18 years. And now it was interrupted a little bit. I'll talk about that later. But you can see the last real estate-based recession was 1990. So all I had to do was count 18 years after that. And I said it might not be exactly 18 years, but somewhere around there. But as it happened, it hit 2008 right on schedule. So the real estate chickens are coming home, but why did the chicken cross the road in the first place? There's all kinds of opinions about what caused the crash. Very few commentators have had a theory or explanation that fits all the pieces of the puzzle together. Unfortunately, in the science of economics, there's no consensus theory of the business cycle. Many economists had thought that recessions were caused by unexpected external shocks, such as an increase in the price of oil or the eruption of new technologies. And the current crisis is blamed on the financial excesses, which ignores the underlying land issue, because you have a financial bubble on top of a land value bubble. So one of the problems in business cycles is that there's no single type of business cycle. There are major cycles combined with minor ups and downs and a few random fluctuations. So if you look at GDP year by year, it looks irregular. But if you see the cat in the drawing, you can see a clear cyclical pattern. As you know, Georges like to say that the economy is like those pictures where there's a jumble of lines and there's a picture in the drawing, and if you look hard enough and you know how to look, you can see the design, such as a cat. And once you've seen the cat, it seems obvious where the cat is. Real estate economists have recognized that there has been for a long time this boom-bust real estate cycle. And during the 1930s, real estate economist Homer Hoyt discovered the 18-year cycle of real estate in Chicago, which coincided with the regular business cycle for the economy as a whole. And then he later did further research and found out that the cycle in Chicago coincided with the general real estate cycle throughout most of the United States. Now you can see every single depression, which is a depression, every single depression or panic has been preceded by a real estate boom. So real estate values and construction have peaked 1 or 2 years before the depression, every single time. So that indicates that real estate is a cause of the subsequent downturn. Now, there have been recessions that were not caused by real estate. For example, the recession of 2001 in the US was caused by the technology boom and then made much worse by the disaster of 9/11. In 1970, there was a recession in the United States caused by an increase in interest rates by the Fed, not caused by real estate. So these were relatively minor downturns. So here we have the cat, and the history of the real estate cycle lets the cat out of the bag. But this data does not create an explanation by itself. For that, you require a theory. And the puzzle in the theory is the downturn. It's easy to understand why an economy expands. People want to improve their lives. Businesses want to do better. But why don't economies just keep growing steadily? Why do they peak out and turn down? That's the puzzle. And so the key to the puzzle is not at the peak, but in the middle of the boom. the economy, this is noticeable, the economy starts turning down here, but the cause of this downturn is already here in the middle of the boom, as the economy, in the middle of the expansion. So the middle of that expansion is called the point of inflection. Ah, thank you, yeah. This is the point of inflection, right here. Now, if you know calculus, the slope at any point on this curve is the first derivative, but the change in the slope is the second derivative. So what's important is how fast the slope is changing. So this is the change in the rate of growth. So at the peak of the boom, here, the point of inflection, the second derivative, which shows how fast the economy is growing or shrinking, changes signs. It goes from positive, it changes signs here from positive to negative. And once the rate of growth turns negative, in other words, the economy is still growing, but at a slower rate. So the change in the rate of growth is now negative. So the growth slows down. As it continues to be negative, it then pulls the economy down. Thank you. So when that second derivative is positive, that means growth is speeding up. Economy is growing faster and faster. When that second derivative flips to negative, that means growth is now slowing down. The economy is still growing, but at a slower and slower pace. And if that rate of growth stays negative, growth slows to zero at the peak, the cycle peaks out, growth turns negative, and the economy slides into a recession. At the bottom of the cycle, the economy is depressed, and so we have a depression. So how does this happen? Why does the rate of growth turn from positive? Why does the change in the rate of growth turn from positive to negative? Well, the story can be told with the Austrian school theory of this business cycle, which starts with capital goods. Capital goods are goods which have been produced but not yet consumed. By the way, one thing I like in the Austrian school economics is they have a very precise term for the factor called capital. People often just say land, labor, and capital, but the word capital can also mean financial capital, and then it gets confused, and then you call the return on capital interest, which is the return on financial capital, but it's not a very bad term for the return on capital goods. So it's much clearer to call the factors land, labor, and capital goods. Then it's clear that it's the factor and not financial capital. So capital goods are goods which have been produced but not yet consumed. You can think of capital goods as the tools of production, like machinery, buildings, and inventory. Now, here's the thing about in the Austrian school. Capital goods have a time structure. Neoclassical economics treats capital goods as a homogeneous mass, and the Austrians say that's a mistake. They're missing a large part of the picture. Think of capital goods as a stack of pancakes, and the ones at the top are the higher order goods, and those at the bottom are called lower order goods. The higher order goods, the top of the pancake, they take a long time to build, and it's a long time until you get your money back. It turns over slowly. But the bottom pancake turns over rapidly. Like inventory, which is also called circulating capital. So the higher order the capital good, the more sensitive it is to the interest rate. So with inventory, like food on the shelf of the store that will be turning over in a couple of days, you don't care what the interest rate is, your money's not tied up very long. But with capital goods at the highest order, mainly real estate and real estate construction, your money's tied up for a long time, the rate of interest becomes very important. So high rates of interest flatten the stack of pancakes. Think of trees that take 50 years to mature. If the tree grows at 3% a year in value, and the market rate of interest is 4%, you're not going to plant that tree. But if the market rate is less than 3%, the tree is growing at 3%, you're going to plant that tree. Now, if the interest rate is set by the free market, there's no problem. If there's more savings, right, it leads to lower interest rates because the banks have more money to lend out. If there's more savings, there's also less consumption. So the less consumption is offset by more investment that's borrowed, especially in the capital goods. Now, and everything is in balance. But in our economic systems, the central bank, such as the Federal Reserve in the United States, manipulates interest rates. And, you know, when the media announces that the Federal Reserve is reducing interest rates, or your central bank is reducing interest rates, in the United States, the relevant rate that's targeted is called the federal funds rate, which is the interest rate used when banks loan money to one another. And then the other interest rates are influenced by that. Now, the Federal Reserve does not set that rate, does not tell the banks what rate to use. It targets it by manipulating the money supply so that that's the rate that the market sets. Now, the Federal Reserve lowers the targeted federal funds rate by buying bonds, usually treasury bonds, although now it's buying bad mortgages. And how does it pay for those bonds? It creates the money to pay them with. If you buy bonds, it reduces your bank account balance. When the Federal Reserve buys bonds, they create the money to buy the bonds with. That's how they create money. So our money is fiat money, not backed by any commodity. The Federal Reserve and the Central Bank of Australia and all the other central banks, they create money out of nothing by decree. The Fed goes poof, and the bank now has more money in reserves, money that can be lent out. This Fed-created money acts as if there were more savings, right? Banks lower the interest rate to loan out that extra money. And at that lower interest rate, there's more investment in the higher order capital goods, such as real estate construction and development. It's important to recognize that this new investment is artificial. It's boosted by the manipulation of interest rates by the Fed. As these investments would not have been made at the higher interest rates, at the natural interest rates that would have been set by a free market. And the problem is planned savings did not change. The amount people intend to save did not change. So the new investment competes with planned consumption and prices rise. That new money creates inflation, price inflation, but prices don't all rise at the same rate. Prices rise faster and sooner where the new money is being loaned out, such as for purchasing real estate. That's why we have the real estate boom, where real estate prices rise a lot faster than other prices. And then economists look at the consumer price index for consumer goods, and they say, see, inflation is not so bad. Meanwhile, you have huge asset price inflation, which is the heart of the problem. So at first, we may not see much increase in the consumer price index or consumer goods, and people think inflation is still under control. But you have rising asset prices both in real estate and in the stock market. We had a stock market bubble on top of a real estate bubble. All right, so that's the Austrian school side, but that's only half the story. Land is the other half. So as the economy recovers from a recession, at first there's a decrease in vacancies, and then when vacancies are low, rents rise, and then the price of land rises, and then speculators jump in when they see land prices going up, as they expect rentals to keep rising. And when real estate prices rise, as you know, it's the price of land, not the value of the buildings. In California, where I live, the supply of land for development was artificially reduced by restrictions like zoning and land use controls, which is why California land prices are higher than the rest of the country, most of the rest of the country. But the biggest reason why real estate prices rise in an economic expansion is the huge implicit subsidy granted to real estate owners. As you know, public goods and civic services increase the value of land, and little of this is paid from the property taxes, specifically on land. So these public goods get capitalized into higher land value and more rent. And then tax advantages, such as reduced capital gains taxes when you sell real estate, tax deductions for mortgages and property taxes, all of those makes real estate more attractive. Now, this doesn't really benefit a new buyer because it's already capitalized in the higher price of land. But people just see these tax subsidies, so they have the illusion that they're benefiting. So the whole system, the whole financial system depends on ever-increasing land prices. As the economy expands, land prices keep going up. Leveraged ownership can reap huge profits, and the speculative demand makes prices go up even further. So in the USA, land prices doubled from 2000 to 2006, and obviously that was not sustainable. And the Federal Reserve had lowered the federal funds interest rate down to 1% after 2001, an extremely low rate, which then influenced other rates. So real estate purchasing, construction, and land values all escalated exactly as theory predicts. There was an economist in the United States, his name was Robert Shiller. Has anybody heard of him?
Yes.
Yeah. So he wrote a book called Irrational Exuberance. And Shiller, who studied real estate prices, wrote that we experienced in the 90s into up to 2006 the greatest real estate boom in history, and this was a worldwide boom. You had this all over the world. And what made this boom bigger than the previous booms was the huge explosion in the secondary loan market. Bankers were selling their mortgages to the government-sponsored enterprises popularly called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These were started by government to promote the purchase of housing. They were nominally privatized in that people owned shares of stock in these companies, but they were still tied to the government and had an implicit government guarantee, which has now become explicit as these institutions failed and the federal government has taken them over directly. So with these guarantees and government-sponsored mortgage resale markets, the banks went hog wild. They were lending out adjustable-only, interest-rate-only mortgages, adjustable loans, adjustable-rate loans, and buyers with rather poor credit were able to get loans. In fact, they were called liar loans because the buyer lied about their income in order to get the loans. They knew they were lying. The banks knew they were lying. They didn't care. They could sell the loan to Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae. And so rather than reduce risks, the secondary mortgage market has spread the financial risks worldwide because they package the mortgages. They take 20 or 30 mortgages as a big securities instrument and sell it to insurance companies, hedge funds. In fact, all over the world they were being sold. That's another thing. They were rated AAA because the rating company was corrupt. They were being paid by the very bonds that the very companies that they were rating. They were getting the fees from them, so they had the incentive to rate them well to get the business. And then, for some reason, even though this was somewhat known, these firms that bought these packages believed the ratings. And they figured that real estate, you could have a few failures, but you wouldn't have a systematic, complete downturn in the mortgage market. So they were betting on that, and they were wrong. There's always been a tendency during a boom, and this has happened in the past cycles, that lending standards always get loose during a boom. Because if a loan gets bad, they can be bailed out by higher prices for the real estate. But when property prices stop rising, the defaults go up, as they have been doing. Banks tighten the lending standards, as they're now doing. But that only reduces the demand for real estate even more. It makes it more difficult to sell real estate and puts even further downward pressure on prices. So high prices for land then choke off new investment. And at that point of inflection, the second derivative goes from positive to negative already because you have less and less affordable real estate as the prices go up and up and up. So as you go toward the top of the cycle, costs go up, interest rates are going up, real estate is more expensive, and therefore with higher costs, businesses expect lower profits. And therefore with expectations of less profit, there's less investment. And investment drives the business cycle. When investment falls significantly, the whole economy is going to fall. We already saw investment in the GDP accounts. They single out investment as one of the components. We've already seen investment falling during 2007. And throughout 2008, investment continuously fell, right? And yet, in the first two quarters of 2008, GDP was going up. So people said, well, see, this time is different. And I was quite confident that the economy had to fall because investment drives the business cycle. That's exactly what happened in Japan also. During the 1980s, you had a huge real estate boom. Yeah, you had a huge real estate boom, which then caused over 10 years of stagnation. The Japanese economy never really recovered. And they had all these public work programs that people are now proposing, and they didn't get Japan out of the stagnation. And real estate prices fell in Japan as much as 80% in some places. So we had that warning from Japan, but people didn't pay attention. So as real estate prices collapse, it brings down the financial industry, and then the financial industry then stops making loans because they've had all these losses, and then that hurts the real economy more. So it's a kind of a negative feedback situation. So I called it a financial waterfall. So we were going down here in 2007. This was inevitable. There was just no way to prevent it. There was nothing. Once you were down at that stage, there was nothing a central bank could do to stop it. So what has been the response of government? The U.S. government has spent or pledged $7 trillion to deal with the financial crisis. That's half the GDP of the United States. $7 trillion, and there's this article on CNN Money that actually atomizes what this was spent for. And incredible. So this is all, the whole worldwide depression is a cost of not having done land value taxation. And
how much of this money is to prop up property prices?
Well, I can go through the figures, actually. But let me just finish my talk, and then I'll talk about that. There's several indications that you could see in the market for where real estate going. There's the Dow Jones U.S. Real Estate Index, whose symbol is IYR. That topped out in February 2007. So that was a signal that things were declining. And so what is different today than from past real estate cycles is that we now have more sophisticated financial instruments such as the Case-Shiller real estate futures market. So it's now possible to hedge or speculate on a real estate decline. You could make money now if you know that real estate is going down, or at least you could have made money if you had gotten in at the peak. But none of those instruments have affected the downturn. So the economy is still plunging down the waterfall. In my judgment, the best way to stop it is to get down to fundamentals. Don't bail out the banks or the speculators or the landowners. My policy prescription is that the key problem in a depressed economy is credit constraints. Nobody can get credit, and the economy runs on credit. And so get down to the fundamentals. The ultimate credit is cash, right? And so I would say that the Australian government is giving, $1,000 to pensioners and to parents, to a few people. It's not enough. It's not going to do much. What I would do is just give every single resident $10,000 in cash. And then you would spend it or pay debts or put it in a bank. Whatever you do would help the economy. It's almost a free lunch during a depression because you have the problem is deflation, not inflation. But they're not doing that. So one thing I can predict with absolute confidence is that government chiefs and even most economists will not learn the right lessons from the collapse. And history will repeat itself, will have another boom and another bust. Except that next time the U.S. government, I think, will be all tapped out. The federal debt will be so high, it'll be several times what it is now. It already doubled during the Bush presidency from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. That's just the official debt. There's unfunded liabilities of about $50 trillion in what they owe for Social Security and Medicare and so on. That's not going to be covered by the current tax rates. So after the next boom and bust, if the U.S. government is all tapped out, there'll be nobody left to bail out anybody. So we better get it right the next time. And so this is a unique opportunity for Georgists to educate the public that you just have one more chance. If we don't have land value taxation now and prevent the next boom, it'll be all over. It'll be much worse the next time when the U.S. government can't bail out anybody anymore. Thank you, and I'll be pleased to answer questions.